in our workshop. I hope that this is the one that you wanted to be at. It's about the brave work that my organization, Western State Center, has been doing for the last 3 years. My name is Amy Santos Lyons. I'm director of program. Western State Center is a regional social justice movement building organization. We're based here in Portland, Oregon, but we work in 8 Western states, from Alaska to Wyoming, all the way down to Nevada. I'm a recovering Catholic and a member in church. I am on the board there and have been a UU member for the last 12 years. And I'm joined in this workshop with some wonderful friends.
So I think we'll get started here. My colleague Keith Cron will be back shortly. This is GA workshop number 335. Are you considering the ministry? And since this is being taped, if you have a question at some point, just please come forward to the microphone so we can capture your voice for perpetuity. My name is David Petit. I serve the association as the ministerial credentialing director. I've been in my role working in Boston.
And so our goals for this workshop are modest. As you know, here in the United States, the dominant story around reproductive health and
this
reproductive
is what you
rights
were talking about.
Has been primarily been through the lens and the leadership of white feminist leadership. And reproductive justice as a movement has really been born out of the lives and leadership of women and transgender people of color. And that these are our experiences and the analysis that we share and offer to folks who might be much more familiar with reproductive health and rights. I came into the movement through reproductive health and rights. I was an organizer in the Philippines, where I grew up. And as a young person, I was a sexuality educator. I would go into urban poor communities. I would wear that apron with the genitalia and the reproductive anatomy. Teach them how babies get born.
Hello.
And talked a lot about teenage pregnancy prevention. That was the framework that we were steeped in. And then when I was around 20, I got unintendedly pregnant. And the Philippines is a very Catholic country, and abortion is still illegal.
So as
but because
I was saying,
unprepared to be a parent at that time, I had an illegal
years.
Abortion. And had to
my
access
primary purpose is
to
be supportive to aspirants and candidates as
network,
they move forward towards
to be able
preliminary
to have a
fellowship,
safe,
which
abortion.
Is a granting
was able to
of
afford that
status by the ministerial fellowship committee,
privilege.
Which in
but
a
many
sense
of the young people who I was working with at
and
the time,
and to understand
who lived in the urban
the
poor
UUA
shanty towns
as,
that I worked in,
an organization
could not
behind
afford
you.
An abortion.
And those of you
and
who
so
were
when
at the
they
service
became
of the living tradition last night
15, 16,
got to
or
see those ministers who had received
had
preliminary
no
fellowship in the past year, final fellowship, et cetera.
And unfortunately, my reproductive health framework
I want to honor and appreciate
that I was steeped
that
in at the time
somewhat of a difficult
had no tools,
to
had
walk
no
across
resources,
the threshold into
had
this
no conversation
room.
To share with them.
It's fairly common
it
in my experience with this workshop, which
right?
I do every year,
pregnancy prevention program.
To see people whom I have seen before in previous years who are still thinking about ministry
and, so I was
and
heartbroken
waiting for the right time,
as I saw
to
many of my peers and my the youth leaders that I was
profession.
Working with. Have very
before
limited
I go any further, I
want
to lift up that there are two people
and finding
in the room
my reproductive
from
health
the Ministerial
very
Fellowship
limited
Committee.
And very narrow.
In the back is
and
Jesse
unable
King.
To speak
you want
to
raise
needs
your
and
stand
their
up, Jesse? Jesse is the incoming chair of the Fellowship
Committee. Fortunately,
I came
committee.
Upon
He's reproductive
a layperson
justice.
From Golden, Colorado.
And here in the United States,
and Joetta Prost,
it was birthed
I'm not sure
by
what congregation
mostly
you're from, so maybe you
primarily
can say.
Black women
okay.
in
also
the South.
Incoming to the MSC.
Again, lifting up the range of issues and experiences and needs that connect to their body sovereignty, connect to their self-determination, but are never identified as reproductive rights issues, right? Don't fit into the conversation around choice. And that in many ways, they didn't have choices. And so I really come and
Are there any other representatives from
and am in service
seminaries
of that movement
here? Often there are folks from different.
3 years ago, my organization, again, trying to lift up the lives and the leadership of women of color around these issues, began to convene leaders and organizations of color.
It's not uncommon for me to receive
emails
and phone
calls. Because, again, the dominant story in
the
United States is that reproductive health and
Boston
rights work is led by white-led organizations.
And my position
at the
UUA has really nothing to do with ordination. Ordination is a privilege that's bestowed
primarily here in Portland,
only
Oregon,
by congregations upon people whom they want to ordain
numerous
into
ballot
the ministry.
Choice.
And I have
and
to
in
sort of
all those campaigns,
remind people that the
none,
work I do at the association
no
is to
organizations
help them
of color were ever asked by
the
choice organizations
to gain preliminary
to
fellowship, which I'll tell you a bit about.
So at the
and
beginning of our
we
project, we actually
I'll
did a
41 kind of
organization scan, and I went to every movement leader of color I
and
knew.
And I'll invite Keith, who is
and
the
I asked them, what are your values
the
around
to
reproductive
talk about
rights
the reality of what's going
and
on
around
in
abortion specifically?
Life.
And of the 41 leaders I talked
to,
all but one said that they staunchly believe in, value, and defend.
When anyone contacts either
rights.
Myself or Chris Spiegel,
but not a single one had ever been
asked
to endorse a choice
for the ministerial
campaign.
Credentialing office.
And if I
asked,
when I asked them
Marion
what the relationship
Bell,
was
who
with
the
choice organizations,
fellowship
it was
committee
contentious.
We consider
right?
you to be an
and
inquirer.
Full of distrust.
And on any given
so my
month,
organization, being a movement-building organization, wanted to convene and help bridge those two movements.
With my office
because frankly,
saying, I'm
we're not
in
each other's enemies.
What do I have to do?
Right?
I'm
there was
a
very real enemy
tradition.
Out there
how
who
do I
opposes
transfer my credentials?
Our rights.
Do I have to go to seminary at all and everything in
and
between?
And we needed to get through the historical
so we
distrust
figure at
and
the
really
moment
build
we have roughly
thoughtful,
around 200 or
authentic,
so people in our
and
system
accountable
who are
relationships.
Thinking about ministry, they're kind of they haven't
so 24
made a
commitment. Months ago, we
talked
to all those leaders.
Formal process
we
to,
convened a
to
core leadership
paperwork,
of women of color
is what's necessary
who
to
wanted
begin
to talk about this,
preparing
but
for
had
the
never
next
been
aspect
asked to talk
or
about
process
this.
Of ministerial fellowship.
When I asked them about their connections
aspirant.
To abortion and reproductive
and the
justice,
process is
people
not a particularly
disclosed
difficult
their abortion
one,
stories.
Other than with the expectation
stories that they had not told in 20 years.
Sorry, I had to find out where this is coming
from. Right?
Okay. Sure.
And then we talked to other folks and brought them in. And we became a bigger community. And together,
thank
we sort
you.
Of locked the door, was in a room just like this.
So
and
becoming
we built
an aspirant
a
is a largely paperwork
for what
process.
It would look
it's
like
sort of a way
if our
for
movements
to get
were working
to know,
together,
to get to know
if
a little
we were
bit
not
about
siloed.
You. More and more, this process takes place online.
And we talked
online,
about what a just and compassionate world would look like, where every
but
person
we want to know who you
in
are,
every family,
where you live,
in every community,
what seminary that you're attending, or if you've graduated,
instead of shame or silence,
which one you've graduated from,
and
or
where
the
all
one
of us
that you'll be
thrive.
Starting in the fall. Part of becoming an aspirant
and our
is
conversations
getting a letter
really
of
came
reference
around
from a union
how,
minister, presumably, usually your home minister. A recent change that's taken place within the process in the last 3 or 4 months is aspirants would begin a process of preparation toward. Eventually meeting what was called the Regional Subcommittee on Candidacy, which was a credentialing body of the association.
Doctor,
that was half clergy,
piano.
Half lay folks. There was one that
we
met in Portland, one that met in Boston each
straight,
twice a year.
Straight cisgender family.
Who had
is
as,
the power
as their purpose to try to gauge
to
whether
American
someone
society.
Had potential for ministry.
And
they
policy,
would give people a lot of excellent feedback.
The stories
so
we tell
so
one
on.
Another.
Because of budgetary issues yeah. at the association,
and if you follow
the entire regional
picture,
subcommittee on candidacy process was cut from the budget.
Right?
So that is no longer part of
so
the
what
process
we're
going
to ask you to do right now is to actually
which,
go through
for a number of aspirants
that millennia
and candidate, aspirants
of events
who had some anxiety
of cultural
about
beliefs,
meeting with a credentialing
of the
body.
Stories, of the
they
policies, of the laws that
and
reinforce
there are a number of people who are not so happy,
this
but
image.
It's the reality of living in times where our resources are limited. And I'll talk a bit about what's going to be developing
and if you could just this timeline
as an ancillary thing to the loss of the RSCCs.
Breathe deeply. It's a very
one of the critical pieces around becoming an aspirant now is what we call
justice.
Congregational sponsorship, which is essentially a relationship that you will have with a UU congregation who agree to endorse you. And what endorsement means? We all set? Thank you. Good. I won't lose my voice now. So what endorsement means is that a congregation recognizes that you have some potential. They want to try to support your development toward ministry. It can be anything from we endorse you, we sponsor you, please write a column for our newsletter, maybe you can teach an adult religious education class or work with the kids or preach in the summertime, all the way to we're going to pay your entire tuition in seminary. That happens too. For folks that some congregations really get behind supporting the people who are coming out of them into the ministry. So after becoming an aspirant, this allows the Ministerial Credentialing Office to release a check for $1,000 if you need it. For the purposes of completing a career assessment, there are 8 differing career assessment sites across the country. All of them are pretty much the same in that they're organizations that have clergy who work for them and people who have a background in psychology. So it's kind of half vocational in terms of you fill out a lot of tests, do a lot of writing in advance, and while you're present on the site, they complete the MMPI, the Minnesota Morris Personality Instrument, which is the pretty standard psychological test, which eventually gets scored. The results of all these tests and the visit get shared with you in a document that you see first, and then after you sign off on it, it gets released to my office, okay? This is quite a bit different than many other faith traditions who have the same requirement, where instead the document goes straight to denominational headquarters and they say, thanks so much, it's been great, and you never know why. But you get this document first. So there's a real commitment toward transparency. No surprises around this process. We will be expecting now that in seminary, or if you've already come out of seminary, some kind of evaluation of field experience, which is a fairly common commitment at most seminaries. I would say that these days there are approximately 70 seminaries across the country that have at least one UU student. That number has gone up considerably in the last 15 or 20 years. There are, however, 10 seminaries in which there are clusters of UU students, and there are 2 seminaries that are UU identified, which include Starr King School for the Ministry in Berkeley and Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago. And I would add that there is a long historical relationship, particularly on the Unitarian side of our movement, with Harvard Divinity School, which you will learn deeply about as part of our history. So there's a significant community of UU students at Harvard, as well as Meadville Lombard, Starr King, Iliff Seminary in Denver, Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., United Theological Seminary in the Twin Cities, Claremont in Southern California. Seattle University tends to have a good cluster of UU students every once in a while, and I'm forgetting one. Anyway, I'm close. Union, thank you. Union Theological School in New York, right. Although people are eligible to attend any seminary, along with the understanding that the seminary is approved by the Association of Theological Schools. And if you are attending a seminary which is not an ATS school, there's another process you have to engage to be able to get sort of credit for your MDiv degree. The MDiv degree program typically takes 3 years full-time. Some schools have found ways to integrate the field education learning internship experience within 3 years, but you can typically expect 3 to 4 years full-time or longer, of course, if you're going half-time. When I was in seminary back in the 1980s, everybody went to seminary residentially. You usually moved, went for 3 years, off into the world you went. These days, with the onset of technology, the number of programs that are low residency, virtual, intensives, they're all very different. So some seminaries will say, no, you have to do everything residentially. More and more are saying, no, you can stay where you are. Maybe pick up some classes at a local seminary where you live, but we'll see you twice a year for a week to do the intensive work. So you, as you think about differing theological schools, you might want to sort of ask them what their expectations are around the program. And in particular, if you can find Unitarian Universalist graduates or active students, they will be able to give you a good sense of what it's like to be a UU in the midst of almost certainly a theological school that has a Christian identity. I believe there may be one or two that have somewhat of a Buddhist identity, plus the two UU schools, but almost every place else, you're going to encounter Christianity in some form. The third sort of big piece of ministerial credentialing is clinical pastoral education. This is essentially a 12-week, usually, or a six-month commitment of half-time as a chaplain. And I think for most people, the experience of going to seminary involves a lot of thinking cool theological thoughts and shaking up how you understand the world theologically. And then when you go to clinical pastoral education, or CPE, it's your first week, and you're in the hospital, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're on call, and you're the chaplain. And you say, I don't know what I'm doing. Doesn't matter. The family sees you as the chaplain. And I think for lots of people, that experience of being in that ministerial role is one of the most formational experiences that we get to have in terms of beginning to understand a sense of what your own identity as a minister is, where you hold your authority, which become critical parts of ministerial formation as you move forward. The other next sort of big piece of credentialing is an internship. These days, the internship requirement is either 9 months full-time or 2 years half-time. I would say approximately close to two-thirds of people who are in process do an internship in a UU congregation. There's another third that are interested in service in the community, and more often than not find some kind of pastoral care setting to do a community ministry internship. That was my own path that I took back almost 25 years ago, doing 4 units of clinical pastoral education in a hospital as an internship. Part of my work at the association is to oversee the internship clearinghouse, which is essentially a web-based program that allows congregations to put up that they are offering internships, gives students an opportunity to say, hey, I'm looking for an internship. And I spend a lot of time in conversation with supervisors and committees and students trying to help figure out matches and so forth. So that's the other sort of big time commitment in terms of the fellowshipping process. If you have prior experience as a minister, there are ways to get waivers for some of this stuff. So I genuinely spend most of my time, when I'm not in meetings, helping people navigate the unique circumstances that they live with. Because I'm kind of sharing with you the typical process, and then folks have to kind of bounce off of it and find the places where it works. So no one is ever bothering me to call me, to drop an email, to say, I don't know how to handle this. That's really what I see my job is, to help people figure out how to be creative. So it saddens me when I hear of folks who've decided to take a different pathway when they never even asked whether what they wanted to do was even possible. And in these days of entrepreneurial ministry and creativity, I can assure you the requests for doing things differently is really taken off. And I expect that it will continue to do so. The last thing I'll mention before inviting Keith to speak, the pivotal sort of end result of all of this preparation is a meeting with the Ministerial Fellowship Committee. It's a body of 7 ministers and 7 lay people whom you spend the first 10 minutes preaching a sermon, no matter where or how you intend to serve, and then typically 45 to 50 minutes of questions. And what they're trying to gauge from you is that you hopefully have remembered some of the things that you learned during seminary. They're going to be interested to try to get a sense of whether or not you have more than just a visceral understanding of Unitarian Universalism. I mean, can you talk about your relationship to our movement? Can you talk about our history, the unique and creative ways that we do religious education? Do you understand our governance, how we get things done? As well as talk about your own personal theology, be able to be accountable to the places that you have enormous gifts and strengths, but also the places that are old wounds from your family of origin that you need to be attentive to. They're looking for a sense of integration and a sense that you're basically competent to serve as a UU minister. There are approximately 60 interviews a year. In this past year, over 90% of people who came through were granted fellowship on the first visit, which is very, very high and speaks to the incredible preparation that you folks are getting. That's far more than I got 20 years ago, I can assure you. So I think the last thing I'll mention is that there are a couple of hundred people who are inquiring about ministry. There are 200 people who are currently aspirants, and there are 200 people who are currently candidates. So that may seem like an awful lot of people in the pipeline, and these days there are more ministers who are members of the UUMA than at any time in our history. And now I'm going to invite Keith to carry us forward here.
I'm Keith Cron. I'm director of the Transitions Office for the UUA. I oversee the ministerial settlement process for congregations and ministers. And I work with congregations as they seek new ministers, both full and part-time. Every year, we average about 45 congregations looking for full-time positions for settled, and another 45 or so for interim. We probably have another 100 congregations or so looking for part-time ministry of some kind, often as small as 1/4 or 1/8% of a full-time. That becomes important for you all to know and think about as you think about potentially finding a position once you're through with seminary and through the ministerial fellowship committee process. Because while we are currently experiencing a shortage of ministers at the moment, and we don't know whether or not that will continue, that does not necessarily mean it will be easy to find a position, and it does not necessarily mean you'll be able to find a position that pays full time. And that is something to definitely consider as you think about this. And even if you look at potentially going somewhere full-time, we have the last two notices I got from newly settled positions had a salary and housing total allotment of about $45,000 for the year. And at least one of these people had significantly more debt from their seminary than that. So that is something to consider as you move forward. Is this something that you can afford? And when you graduate, will you be able to afford it? Because our congregations are also dealing with shrinking resources in many cases, and they are trying to figure out how, in fact, they can pay for full-time ministry. I've seen a trend downward in terms of more and more congregations looking at, or at least considering, sharing ministry. We have, for the first time, two congregations that weren't full-time sharing a full-time interim minister next year. We have more and more congregations who did have two ministers now looking at only having one minister or 1.5 ministers serving their congregations. The changing economic realities of our society and ministry and church are going to be significant. The generation of folks who went to church and who believe that what you did is you showed up on Sunday morning and you contributed to the church just because that was the right thing to do are aging out. So congregations are going to have to become increasingly diverse in how they look at how they get funds. The other side of that is you will have any number of folks who will have less time to volunteer in congregations. We have still tried to live with what I refer to as a 1950s model of congregational life, and that model is quickly disappearing. And what church means in the future is going to be something that continues to evolve. We're working with congregations to begin to alter this. What is interesting in our congregations is that most of the people who have the power, and by that I mean the money contribute, are still wedded to a 1950s version of what church is. So some of these congregations may not be well prepared to look at a new kind of ministry. It is interesting to watch some of our congregations say what they want in a minister, and the reality is very different from what they say they want. And many of our congregations serve as oases for like-minded people who want a small group of folks to connect with versus what I believe the next generation of folks would like in church, which is a way to change the world and to support the people who are coming to their congregations. This will be an interesting transition that we and other denominations are living through. And at the moment, it can take a significant toll on ministers. A ridiculously high number of people who enter ministry have just one settlement. And then they discover that ministry is not for them. As a classmate of mine from seminary said when he was in at Star King with me, I can't wait to get into a congregation and to talk about theology with people. This person is no longer serving a congregation. because that is not what the people in the congregation wanted. And we are in a process of shifting what it is, in fact, what congregations want. And they are going to be looking for ministers who can both lead them and not push them too quickly. David talked about all the things that the Ministerial Fellowship Committee require from a minister. What I look for in ministers to serve congregations are self-awareness, good boundaries, emotional intelligence, and the ability to know when to not talk. And I watch people who don't do any of those four things get in big trouble in ministry. They are there to maybe listen to you on Sunday morning. They may be there more, in fact, to see other people from the community. Often they are not there to listen to you talk to them about how they should do their church. That is a constant sort of rub that I see in congregations. And so particularly people in beginning ministries have to be wary. Often people in their first ministry, the congregations that are open are often more complex and complicated and smaller, with the same 20 people there to drive the minister crazy in a congregation of 110 versus the congregation of 700, which also has 20 people who drive the minister crazy. But there are 680 people around them who will help deflect some of that. And I want you to go in thinking about ministry with a congregation, if that's what you're doing, with as few illusions as possible.
Right.
Because the people who go in with particular illusions are the ones who do not last. You will be there to support, figure out when and how to say things so that people can hear them, so that maybe they will think it is their idea as they institute change in their congregations, those that want change. There will be those that don't. I look around at the people who entered seminary with me, and Wednesday during ministry days, I had a lunch of the people who were in my class and 2 years before. Of the 60 people or so who entered those three classes, there were 9 of us here having lunch who are still engaged in ministry. And that's from 20 years ago.
Right.
So all things to think about as you think about moving forward. It can be a very rewarding career. Dave and I are two of the dinosaurs who've managed to stick it out for 20 years now, but
right.
We are an increasingly smaller number of folks who stick around.
That's right.
So as you think about this, think about whether or not only is this something you want to do, but can you see yourself doing it for a particular period of time? And can you see it as the needs of ministry will significantly change between now and the next 20 years?
I wanted to mention one last thing before we open it up for questions. With the loss of the Regional Subcommittee on Candidacy System, which was an important threshold experience for people to go through, way back in the 1990s when the RSCCs, as they were called, were created, there was the vision of having more support from local ministers and local lay people to kind of help people with their ministerial formation. It never was funded, it never went off the ground, and within a very short period of time, these committees became much more focused on evaluation and not so much on support. I completed an evaluation of the RSCC system back this January, and what was very clear from every single group that I spoke with, which included ministers and people in the process and folks from seminaries across the board, was a desire for much more support. Seminary tends to be an excellent experience for preparing you for thinking theologically and for a career in the academy. Not so much sometimes in terms of actually helping you to function and flourish and thrive in a congregation or in a community. And so there have been six differing pilot programs across the country connected with some of the larger seminaries that have a good UU population that are developed. We're in the process of developing, hopefully over the course of the next year, a continentally based in-care program where people who enter into aspirant and candidate status will find that there are ministers and lay people and other folks that are going to be wanting to sort of help you with your questions around discernment, to give you support, not to evaluate you, not to fill out a whole bunch of forms, but to figure out ways to fill in some of the gaps around dealing with financial concerns, how to supervise staff, the real-life practical dimensions of ministry that typically are not part of an MDiv curriculum. In these places where these in-care programs have been successful, they've all been successful, I think students have felt, in a sense, much more appreciated by the association, much more comfortable in terms of their relationship with other UU ministers, and it's just been a really positive development to help people kind of move forward, not feeling so incredibly isolated. The reality of seminary these days is that more and more people are not going to seminary. They're staying where they are, and they're the only person in town, and they may be the only person that they know who's in seminary other than for 2 weeks of the year. So we're trying to find ways to think about how to deal with folks who are geographically scattered all over the U.S. and Canada who are interested in becoming ministers. So we'll open it up for questions now. We have... How long?
45 minutes.
45 minutes. So if you could just come to the microphone and just say your name and where you're from, and we'll just take it from there.
Hi. My name's, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. My name's Joe Rettenmeyer. I'm from Westside in Seattle, Washington. And I am familiar with called ministry and interim ministry, mm-hmm. but I keep hearing about this entrepreneurial ministry mm-hmm. that's emerging.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you two wisdom holders could share what is that?
Okay.
And what real world situations right now are you seeing that you are calling entrepreneurial?
Oh, this one's all yours. I just work with congregations, let me tell you, so.
This is a good question. The concept of entrepreneurial ministry is something that's been a fascination of President Morales and Don Southworth, who is the executive director of the UUMA. They've been meeting with, these days, representatives from local business schools to try to figure out ways to imagine ministry that is taking place outside congregations. It's a little difficult to describe to the extent that the skill set involved in terms of functioning as a minister in an environment where ministers have not been before is not something you're going to learn in seminary. And so there are ways that folks are trying to deal with issues around environmental justice, reproductive rights that require the capacity and ability to figure out business plans, to learn how to raise money, to be able to envision the growth of an organization, to find some way to maintain some sort of relationship or accountability to a congregation, or to our UUA principles and purposes. It's a way of recognizing that congregations, in terms of how they've always understood ministry, are evolving. I mean, Keith mentioned a bit about how some congregations, it's almost like we're going backward in time historically, where we're sharing ministers among congregations, but doing that differently in ways. So it's a way of recognizing that some of the old structures are really shifting and changing. And there are going to be people out there who are going to sort of want to live out a new vision of how Unitarian Universalism can be experienced in the world. And some are going to be wonderful successes. Some are going to be difficult failures. I just think it's a different approach of thinking outside of the traditional ministerial roles that people have been conditioned to understand. It's a little hard to talk about because there aren't, at least to my awareness, all that many lived out examples taking place. So.
Sure. Hi there, my name is Chris Cervantes, and I am from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Waco. First of all, hi Keith. He helped us. We had a very long search process, and we didn't end up being successful in that process. We were not able to call a settled minister. So my church is taking a chance. I'm going to seminary, and they've hired me as the full-time minister. So I'm doing both of those things at the same time. It's very entertaining. I started seminary in January. I'm going to Bright Divinity School in Fort Worth.
Great.
And so I want to be fellowshipped. I want to go, you know, through the credentialing process.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm leery because I don't know what I'm not going to leave my congregation for mm-hmm. a year to go be an intern somewhere else.
Right.
They can't afford it. I can't afford it. And are they my sponsorship congregation for aspirant I've sent in my aspirant paperwork. I don't know. So.
Good. That's a great question. That's a good example of kind of a unique circumstance, which isn't actually all that unique. No, it isn't.
It's very retro.
I think.
I'm told.
Not necessarily. I think what it's reflective of is there are UU congregations that are kind of off the beaten path, that don't pay enough to be able to attract people to come from a distance and cover all of their housing expenses and moves, and so they will either turn to a local minister who's not a UU, or if they're lucky, they'll find someone like you who has the interest in possibly being in fellowship. So with a situation like yours, just to give you an example of how I kind of help navigate that, the concept of you being supervised in the congregation that you currently serve works fine to meet the internship requirement. The challenge becomes to find an internship supervisor, a UU minister willing to do it, but this is not particularly complicated.
Okay, and also just part of this seminary program that I'm in is a CPE. And part of it is supervised ministry.
Good.
And they're going to work with me to find someone in Waco. I'm driving to Fort Worth twice a week. I'm putting 360 miles on my car every week.
Wow.
But they're going to work with me as well. Can they also talk to you about that process?
Sure.
Or?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Oh no.
I feel so much better having come here today.
Oh well, good. Good. And she was not a plant, by the way, so.
Well, David, can I just add to what you just said? The quickest way to get into trouble is to not reach out and to not ask questions.
Here, here.
I mean, that's where we see more people stumble throughout the process, throughout. Get advice. Seek out information from David, from other sources, regional staff, just to really help you get through the process, because people end up doing things that they didn't realize were inadvisable, and they make things harder on themselves throughout
right.
the process.
Right.
I have had great advice from the UU cluster ministers in both Dallas area and the Austin area, so that helped immensely.
Great. One of the things that's going to be happening effective July 1st when the RSCCs are officially gone and the staff person who has been working with them will no longer be working for the association. As people obtain aspirant status, I'm going to contact every single one of them, basically to introduce myself, but to try to get a sense at that point what their journey is, what some of their big burning questions are. It's quite a change. There's been a way in which, and I inherited sort of a philosophy of it's the aspirant or candidate's responsibility to know what they want, and they should reach out. And I realize as I've spent time in my position that people would love to do that, but they don't even have any idea what the question is to ask. And they're often in congregations where there are ministers who went through this process 10, 15, 20 years ago who aren't familiar with what the current understandings are. They don't really know. So I've decided I'm going to reach out to everybody, at least at that very beginning, so they have, you know, if, with questions that they may have, I can at least maybe steer them in some directions that they would otherwise have wanted to avoid, because it can be a costly mistake to the extent that people aren't paying attention. So,
I'm Joseph Erhard Hudson from Unitarian Universalist Church of the Palouse in Moscow, Idaho.
Great.
I got to know Keith through the search process as well. My question relates to the relationship between credentialing and ordination. I appreciate what you said
sure.
about those being
separate
things with
yeah.
separate authorities. That being said, mm-hmm. I've been... You hear different stories depending on who you talk to.
Right.
And the message that I've heard from some parties at a school that will not be named is that, and from other sources as well, is that if you don't jump through the hoops in the right order, if you can jeopardize your, this message I've heard, getting to the end of my rambling here,
okay.
is that if you don't do things in the right order, you can jeopardize your fellowship.
Okay.
What can you address that concern?
Absolutely. I hear
yeah.
it all the time. The Ministerial Fellowship Committee has absolutely nothing to say about ordination because it's a congregational privilege. It's in our bylaws. It is true that most of the people who get ordained have been through the process to receive ministerial fellowship. Most UU congregations, most, will not ordain people until they've done the process. That's the way that our association of congregational life is really respected and held high. There are individual UU congregations that choose and have the privilege to ordain anyone they wish, and they do. In terms of that being seen as some kind of a black mark on your record if you're in the fellowshipping process, what typically happens is the fellowship committee might say something to the effect, we notice that you've been ordained. Can you tell us about your thinking about why you chose this? How come? Not that there's a bad answer, but why'd you do it? So not as a way of trying to understand, did you not understand this process? Were you out of relationship with the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association? They're gauging whether or not there was a reason that makes a lot of sense, or in fact, there are people whom occasionally come into the ministry who have sort of a disregard for rules and regulations and policies, and they're sort of, you know, I don't have to be accountable to structures and things. And that's useful information for the fellowship committee to know about people, so to prevent our congregations from being damaged by people who just refuse to be accountable to anybody. So there are some folks who come from that camp. There are others that say, you know, I was interested in serving a congregation before I even began the process, and they offered me ordination, and I accepted it, and they say, fabulous. There's no automatic black mark whatsoever. And there are concerns as well that I often hear that the UUA will punish a congregation that ordains someone who's not in fellowship, and that I don't know where that comes from. That's false. There's no truth to that.
From Eugene, Oregon. And my question is, I heard discussion about changes in salary structure and expectations for work after completion. And what I'm curious is if the administration is looking at alternative education options where candidates could do self-study and self-testing and things like that to eliminate the debt burden that would go along with the full ministry program.
You want to take the salary stuff?
Why don't you start with the self-study?
Okay. The fellowship committee is in the process right now of taking a look at all of the required ministerial competencies, of which there are 17. Over the last 50 years or more since consolidation, there have been new understandings that ministers need to have particular competencies and skill sets, and they just keep getting added on, and nothing ever gets taken away. So the association and the UUMA, the Ministers Association, went through this long conversation a couple years ago that evolved into a document called Fulfilling the Call, which is available at the bookstore, and the UUMA has copies as well, which is a way of thinking about ministry not so much in terms of a knowledge-based, but more in terms of a skill or competency base. And so the Fellowship Committee is working with that document and will very likely decrease the number of expected competencies from 17 down to 7. They may vote on this as early as December of this year, depending on conversation. There was conversation about whether or not the MDiv, which is sort of the gold standard in terms of education, would be something that would no longer be required. The current thinking at the moment is that it will continue to be the expectation. There has long been a process around folks who bring other graduate-level religion-related experience that they can kind of cobble together with some courses here, some experience there, that will ultimately be voted upon as an MDiv equivalency. I think in the past, most people, they may have been aware it existed. I think one of the ways that the MFC is wanting to signal their openness and willingness to try to deal with some of these creative problems is to make the notion of requesting a waiver not something that seems kind of out of order. And recognizing that people bring different gifts, they have different life experiences, let's just deal with it and see if we can find a way to deal with these kind of, with people who bring a lot of experience that may seem unrelated, but when you put it together, may be adequate to be satisfactory. Did you want to add anything further about salaries?
Salaries and housing, we have recommendations for congregations based on size and where they are. And so a congregation of 120 members in Prescott, Arizona, is going to have a different recommended salary range than a congregation of 400 in San Francisco, just simply because of what it costs to live in a particular area and the size of the congregation. These are recommended guidelines. Congregations struggle to meet them from time to time. And then we have to do an entire bit of conversation and education about fair benefits, which often have gotten confused. We've had ministers walk into congregations and think that they are going to get paid a certain amount and then discover, yes, it's this amount, but your health benefits have to come out of this particular package. So it is always an interesting and precarious time as congregations figure this out, and the stress is continuing to mount on congregations to be fair compensators. If you go to the website for the Office of Church Staff Finance, they will list all the cities in the United States. They might have it up there by Canada. If not, I know that I have it, but I think they do for Canada as well, what their geo index is. And then you look at the size of a congregation, and it gives you the range for what you're supposed to pay, not only for senior minister, but assistant minister, director of religious education, director of music, and so on.
Hi, Matt Aspen from Westside Unitarian in Seattle. I am currently in the middle of a life transition and doing some exploration, and the idea of going to divinity school and becoming a minister is really is bubbled up quite a bit, and I've begun talking to folks about that.
Great.
My fear has been all the Gallup surveys and the decline of religion and, mm-hmm. and you know, as a pillar in our society. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited about some of the things that I'm hearing, and it sounds like the UUA is listening to that and trying to figure out how we're going to adapt and how things are going to change. Where would you suggest, it's very easy to find people to talk to about the decision to go to divinity school and to become a minister or not. And I've heard a lot of really good thoughts about the value of going to divinity school for self-awareness and being able to articulate and help people through some of those spiritual things, mm-hmm. even if you don't become a minister. So that mm-hmm. helps. Mm-hmm. But where would you suggest I look for information to help look for alternative other ways forward, generally in that same direction, if I'm not sure ministry
okay.
is right?
Maybe this will be helpful. When I was first imagining the ministry back in 1985, I went and talked with my minister and said, you know, this thing appears interesting to me. I kind of keep waking up at night thinking about it. I've never understood what that's about. And she said, okay. So she said, I'm going to invite you to make contact with 10 people who are my colleagues. And she handpicked these 10 people. And these were folks who were at the beginning of their ministries, people who were on the verge of retirement, folks who were at the pinnacle of their career, people who were on the verge of being negotiated out of a congregation, folks that were working in the community, in congregations that were theologically humanist, theologically Christian, everything in between. And I just thought she was kind of randomly just giving me the names of 10 people that she knew. But what she was doing was, and she said, go give them a call and invite yourself for a cup of coffee and ask them to talk about what they like about ministry and what they don't. And that process, more than anything else, woke me up in terms of the realities of, as I began to think about what I felt called to, I have the sort of unusual distinction of being a seventh generation Unitarian. It's just part of the way I have been in the world. It's not a chosen faith for me. It just is. So my commitment to Unitarian Universalism from the beginning was foundationally clear. In terms of how I would serve as a minister was really fuzzy when I went to theological school. And as it turned out, when I was in theological school, community ministry didn't even exist as an option. But I went anyways because I kind of trusted the process. So talking with these differing people and then saying, can you think of people I can talk with whom can kind of expand this conversation was remarkable. And the unexpected outcome, more than anything else, was there are people among those 10 that I spoke with that I still have conversation with today. And that was 30 years ago. And I had no idea that that was the beginning of my collegial understandings. So, yeah. You had a question? Can you come to the mic? Yeah, I know. You're going to be famous someday, so I wanted to say we heard you. So, great.
My name is Julia Byrne. I'm from the First Unitarian Church in Philadelphia.
Great.
Along the same lines with the practicality of this, do you have any statistics of how many seeking full-time employment as a UU minister actually find it? And if not, what does this credential possibly open you up to otherwise if you can't find that work?
We had 110 ministers in search. Basically, the last 2 years, around 50 congregations in search this year. Some ministers with experience were only looking at one congregation. Most people who are new were looking at up to 15 different congregations, somewhere between 5 to 15. And for the most part, people who have completed a successful internship have a good recommendation from their internship supervisor, generally find something, if not the first year, then by the end of the second. Yeah. The question then becomes, do they actually really like it? And I really like the suggestion of talking to a variety of different ministers just to sort of learn about what the day-to-day aspects of ministry are.
That was kind of my second question. I mean, how would you divide sort of the actual role of minister in terms, like a breakdown of how you spend your time in a week?
I think you should talk to each minister because they do it really differently. And some of it's a relationship of what the understanding of the covenant that they have with the congregation is about. For some, they're hired for specific dimensions of the ministerial office. You know, people get hired to do the pastoral care, maybe to oversee religious education. Others are more general. There are people who, not very many, who are kind of hired to be the preachers, which sounds fabulous to me, but not too many get that privilege. One thing that Keith didn't mention, which I think may be partly in response to your first question, is he and I sit next to each other at 24 Farnsworth, and after every single meeting of the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, he'll say, okay, who's good to go, you know, what happened with the meeting? And we'll both be sort of struck I'll talk to him a week later to say, well, none of these people want to move. They can't move. And they live in a part of the country where there are no open settlements. And there are congregations that would like a minister, but nobody applies. So what I will say here, which often I often get a little pushback, but that's fine, is encourage people to get ready to move. Move for your internship, move for your CPE, move for your seminary. Avoid the path of least resistance where you stay where you are through your entire formation, because it's going to be really hard to pick up and move, because that's what you're going to have to do if you want to go to work. So that may seem like a really hard thing to say, but there's something that's distressing for me personally and professionally to watch someone go through this long process and live in a part of the country where they're never going to go to work because they can't. And that's not my decision, obviously, but we need people to go. And would you say that the settlement is still largely bi-coastal in that people want to stay on the coasts as they go into search, or?
To some extent, it's still bi-coastal. Vancouver to San Diego is generally pretty popular. Portland, Maine to Northern Virginia is generally pretty popular. Major metropolitan areas, Chicago, Minneapolis, Denver, maybe Atlanta, maybe Dallas, pretty popular. We'll find about Dallas in this year because we have two congregations in search about them. Healthy congregations tend to be more popular than unhealthy congregations. It's hardly a surprise. But why that becomes important is if you are limited in your geography, that can really matter. If the only congregation that comes open that you can potentially serve is one that has gone through settled ministries every 3 years, and then they're back at it again. And to sort of echo a little bit of what David was talking about, I would be very leery if you are hoping for what will be a golden thread to ministry where X happens, then Y happens, and Z happens, and you end up in the congregation that you've always dreamed for, because from my end, that almost never happens. And remember that congregations don't necessarily care that you're in their backyard. They are looking for the best minister to serve them. I have lots of conversations with ministers who go, I'd really like this congregation because it's close. That's almost never on the congregation's radar screen.
And to the second part of that question, any other jobs that this might lend itself to?
So I'm seeing an increasing interest in people who feel called to some kind of pastoral ministry or chaplaincy. There are growing numbers of UUs serving in hospitals, prisons, college campuses, in the military, nursing homes, people who may bring some kind of psychological, social worker, MFT, psychology degree. They're doing pastoral psychotherapy, spiritual direction, which is that's the largest area of community ministry is around that kind of pastoral stuff. There are others that are getting into environmental justice, reproductive rights is another place that you can find Unitarian Universalist leadership. The entrepreneurial ministry kind of goes into that part of ministry. It's less so usually grounded in a congregation. But I think sometimes we see as many as a third of people coming before the fellowship committee who do not feel called to serve in congregations.
Last question.
Sure.
Do you sense any judgment on Unitarian Universalism at seminary from those that are there for Christian
You know, there are some. The more conservative the seminary is, the more that UUs are going to have to probably find ways to be doing constant translation. I went to Star King, as did Keith. I took all of my kind of sort of the courses like Hebrew scriptures and Christian scriptures and world religions, all at Christian schools. I was more intrigued. I didn't feel a sense of resistance to that because I hadn't heard any of it growing up in a UU church. So I was really intrigued with this stuff. I think there are people who come in sort of worried that they're going to be disrespected. I actually don't hear very much of that. Students are more willing to speak up and say this is unacceptable, and seminaries are listening. Now, if you go to a really really fundamentalist school, then you may become more skillful at being able to articulate your theology. But the way that I like to think about it actually is that Peter Morales was talking about this earlier this week. one of his visions is that we're going to be doing more and more interreligious work. And so understanding your Christian colleagues in many small towns, those who your colleagues are, finding a way to understand the world that they live in and being able to join it and find the places that we can share common cause is, I think, is really the wave of the future. So I don't think it's that common that people feel sort of beaten up because they're not Christian. I certainly experienced, you know, being in rooms of students, we're all Christians here. No, we're not. Oh, that's right, you're the UU. So.
But, you know, I think with liberal Christians, it's almost non-existent. Where sometimes we see some pushback, I think, is if you are particularly offended by a particular kind of religious language. I watch people who constantly sort of are trying to remind folks that not everyone in the room is a Christian. Sometimes there's pushback from the larger group. But even then, I often see our Christian colleagues looking at us with a certain longing. Because we are not bound by some of the things they are bound, and they actually would like to see, you know, their particular movements be more open to any number of things that we sort of wrestled with 20 and 30 years ago. And I, you know, so there is a gratefulness. And you know, when we were at seminary, the other folks just sort of looked at Unitarian Universalism is, these are the folks who can talk about anything. And people would come from Christian churches into the Christian seminaries and become too liberal for their Christian churches that they would go and serve.
Right.
UUs would go to the GTU and Harvard and Meadville and other places and become a little bit more conservative theologically than the congregations they would go out and serve. So it was an interesting combination.
I would say the one place that people sometimes find more more challenges in CPE, because you have a covenant group of people who are Presbyterians and Lutherans, clinical pastoral education,
okay.
That's the chaplaincy experience. I did a year of CPE, and I had a colleague who was a Pentecostal minister who for a month didn't know what to do with me because I was never baptized, and she said I had no authority to do what I was doing. We had lots of conversation. And she ended up toward the end of her year of being in CPE, of ministering to the gay community in San Francisco. And it was authentic. She came a really long way. And so did I, actually, because I didn't think very much of her at the beginning.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Me again. on the flip side of what we were just talking about, how is the broad UU world doing about accepting ministers who have a Christian flavor to their own theology?
In terms of congregations?
Yeah, parish ministry in particular.
I'll give you my sense, and then Keith can correct
me. And then
I'll
contradict
you. And then he'll correct me.
Thanks.
There are more, particularly in the Northeast, there are more really old UU congregations that maintain a somewhat of a sense of a Christian identity. I'm only aware of one UU congregation in the last 25 years that sort of emerged with a Christian identity in Michigan, and I don't even know if it's still a going concern. Small, yeah. You know, it's as we're watching the shift in terms of the percentage and the impact of humanism in our congregations toward more, I would say, more comfort with people who are using more reverential language, more God language. I think some of the old fights that took place 25, 30 years ago are decreasing significantly. That being said, there's a UU Christian Fellowship. You can go to their meetings here at General Assembly. And there are plenty of people who will say that in some locations they'll identify as a UU Christian and feel like they're being attacked. And people don't understand how they could possibly feel that way. Sort of the part of the tone of the worship last night at the service of the Living Tradition about how tolerant and open and free are we really? So,
well, a couple of thoughts on that. One of which, every year when we train people who are new to interim ministry, it's led by two United Church of Christ ministers. At the end of every single 3-day session that we do them, and they all look at me and go, any of these folks could serve in a UCC congregation. And to me, that points out what people think of what Christianity is and what it actually is. They're actually two different things. And that gap is shrinking in our congregations. I was with a congregation recently where all of a sudden 10 people stood up and said, well, I used to go to the UCC congregation here. It's not much different from the UU congregation. People were shocked that they said that. The significant demographic trend that is going to really shift this is that, you know, we were so much a religion of the not that. We're not that Christian. We're not whatever. And the next generation of folks are not going to come out of reaction to Christianity. They're going to come with actual questions, and they're less concerned about all of this, provided they don't see you as a single story. And by that mean is if they only see you as a UU Christian, unable to minister to the humanists in the congregation, unable to minister to the people with different theologies, then they're going to have a harder time. And that's a significant shift from when we went into the ministry, where there was more of a reaction toward people who identified as UU Christian. But now there's a much greater openness to people. It's like, as long as you can be my minister and get that I don't use words like Jesus or even God, there is far less reactivity.
I think many UUs, you can come on up. I think many UUs who do clinical pastoral education have to confront the reality of being drawn into a difficult health emergency and being expected to pray by conservative people. And finding a way to use language that you don't use on a daily basis, but mean it in a way that's authentic and real. And that's part of this journey for many of us.
I have two questions. I serve as director of music for two congregations in Los Angeles. And I'm interested in taking my own music ministry to that next level in certain ways. And my two questions are, because ministers of music and directors of music are paid significantly less than even full-time senior ministers
right.
of congregations, would a seminary process be even worth it financially? Would they ever pay it back?
Well, that's a good question. There are a number of seminaries that have considerable tuition stipends that offset the cost of going to seminary. I think this is part of the importance of doing your research. For reasons that are not fully clear to me, many Methodist schools seem to find it within their hearts to give UU students a full ride. Wesley, Boston University, ILEF, Methesco, United Theological Seminary, I think they have something as part of their own commitment to theological diversity to draw people in. So they tend to like UUs. So to the extent that you're able to avoid the trap of accumulating a ton of graduate level debt, then I would say the answer is yes. It would be definitely worth it. To the extent that you're in a program where you walk out with $80,000 in student debt, I'm not so sure. One person whom you might want to talk about this if you haven't already is Jason Shelton, who's in Nashville, who was one of the first sort of people sort of actively in music ministry who came into the ministry and has continued to do that. He would have some reflections and know everybody else who's dealing with these same kinds of questions.
The other question I have with that, if I can ask you, which is important to me, and David and I actually may have different opinions on this, is do you see yourself doing anything other than music ministry?
In terms of as a
in terms
path?
Of what you do with the ministry, could you see yourself going and working as a parish minister as opposed to a music minister?
No, absolutely not.
I mean, because so. what we have seen, what I have seen in congregations like in Chandler, Arizona, which is in your region, and well, and so is Golden, Colorado, the congregation chose to ordain the minister of music as long as that was their intent for what they were going to do for ministry,
right.
was just to stay in music.
Right.
The other question that I had is, does the MFC have a history at all of fellowships anybody with an alternative education background that is not seminary-based or not religious-based?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the MDiv equivalency business. And there's a process that, for people who are interested in exploring that, I kind of share a template of what a typical MDiv education looks like, and then people take a look at the graduate level courses they've taken and kind of see, yeah, I got that, but I got these gaps, and this is how I intend to fill those gaps. And then that particular plan is given to the fellowship committee, and they say it looks great, and then they expect people to accomplish it. So sure, yeah. Got to be fast.
Hi, Claudia from First U San Diego. Hello.
Hello.
So Claudia from First U San Diego, and my question is around ministers that are identified as people of color ministering to a congregation that is not. So do you have any information?
Sure. Do you want to talk about the experience of our colleagues of color in terms of ministry? I can talk about what in terms of folks who are in seminary.
Why don't you start and I'll
sure.
follow.
Okay. These days there are roughly 60 people of color self-identified who are in process. There is, I think, a much greater intentionality around people getting to know each other, to be in relationship with each other. Keith will probably tell you that the experience he finds with our colleagues of color, by the time they get to the fellowship committee, they often are more connected with the association than some folks who are of European descent. There is an annual gathering of seminarians and ministers called Finding Our Way Home, which is funded through the Multi-Faith Growth and Witness part of the UUA, which is an opportunity for people to get together in a rather large group, 80, 90 people, for folks to get to know each other, to sort of find out how people navigate some of the typical tensions that emerge. We've learned a lot over the years around the experience of ministers of color, what we've learned has been through a lot of pain. And I think people we're not forgetting that there's a lot of pain and difficulty with that. And I think the folks in the regional staff people are increasingly sophisticated to be able to say to congregations who seem very excited about this prospect, to be able to get a sense of whether or not the congregation has done the work it needs to do, and to be really clear about why they want to call someone, to be able to prevent some of the sort of normal things that erupt in a congregation that can be incredibly distressing for the minister and distressing for the congregation. So I think the experience that people are having, certainly going through the process, people are doing fine. And I'll let Keith talk about the experience of actually getting settled and how that looks from his perspective.
Let me see if I can do this quickly. You will experience racism as part of the process. If you're gay, lesbian, bi, or trans, you'll experience homophobia, biphobia, or transphobia as part of the process. If you're a woman, you'll experience sexism as part of the process. If you live with some sort of medical condition or some sort of disability, you'll experience ableism as part of the process. Generally, folks with particular identities, particularly around ableism, heterosexism, and racism, do work harder as part of the settlement process. It actually often tends to pay off. We actually have a higher percentage rate of success for ministers of color these days than we do for white people. The reason that is that our ministers of color just do significantly more homework. And they are better connected and rely on more resources. There are things that you can expect when you walk into a congregation. There will be people who will see you as a person of color first and a minister second. That is inevitable. There will be people who will want to be colorblind to the issue. This is not as significant as it was 20 years ago, but it is still there. There will be a third of the congregation that is excited that a person of color is in the congregation because now you can deal with issues of race and racism. There will be a third of the congregation who will be excited that a minister of color is there because it proves they're not racist.
Right.
And there'll be a third of the congregation who is petrified that all you're going to do is talk about issues of race and racism. That is a scenario that every single minister of color serving a congregation has dealt with in our movement. That is not to say you can't have a successful placement. That's not to say that we haven't been working proactively to work on that. We're better. We do anti-oppression training as part of the search process for congregations, which despite the fact that some people think we're done and don't need to do that, it is clear, still very clear to me that it's a necessary part of the process. It was just last year, very recently, that we had a Latino, a person of Latino descent, asked if they only preached out of the African-American tradition. Despite all of the materials in the minister's information describing being of Latina descent, there are still things that will happen. Yeah. And I really think the question becomes, can you get the support from other colleagues and from other people to sort of help you weather the storm, and can the allies in the congregation not make you have to carry this burden alone?
One more quick question.
Sure.
So the other was, it's kind of a double whammy. So yes, I am a person of color, and I'm also pagan.
Okay.
So your experience in placing openly pagan ministers.
That might actually be a plus for you, because it can be harder to limit you to being a single story.
Sweet, thanks.
the temptation is to reduce people to a single story, and I mean, part of what often is helpful is when that doesn't happen is it just sort of makes things easier.
There you go.
Okay, so my question, I've been hearing a lot about multi-site ministries and community ministers and all the different paths that you can take with an MDiv and all this sort of thing, but what is, in terms of going through the search process, how is the UUA helping to facilitate, say, someone in search, or rather, let's say there's two congregations looking for a half-time minister, like, are they going in together, or how often does that happen, or four congregations looking for quarter-time ministers or something like
I
that?
I work with regional staff, and the regional staff are often on it. I've been working with Carlton Elliott Smith, for example, about four congregations in the southern region, exploring the idea of four congregations that want half to three-quarter-time ministry, to consider instead going together and getting two full-time ministers who are well-paid who might better serve those four congregations. And so I've been working with Joe Sullivan in Maine about three congregations going together for two full-time ministries. So it's a collaborative effort based on what people can pay, because congregations that can't pay full-time do suffer in the search process. So it's like, let's get creative here, because that's the future.
And then I've also, I've taken a look on the, are we out of time? Or?
No.
Okay.
We are actually, but.
Oh.
Oh, 4:15?
4:15.
Oh, I had 4:30. Okay, we're out of time.
4:15.
You had the last word. Thank you very much. Please feel free to be in touch with me or Keith. And sure.
No.
so. By the time that you see the end, that's the end of the process. So to become an aspirant, you have an initial inquiry form. You get interviewed with the minister. If you're a transfer, we deal with that. You either send us a letter, you got that. You sign an application. This is a sign we're going to do a criminal background check at the end. And then sponsorship. That's what to become an aspirant.
Should I just start a dialogue with them about that process? Because they've only known me for 3 months.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And there are materials on the UUA website related to what congregational sponsorship involves. So you ought to become familiar with it. There's a form that you can download and the president of the congregation signs. And it's all part of an education process. And depending on the congregation, you may be, they don't know exactly what you're asking. Or they'll look at you like, what is it? They don't know what this means.
Okay. So I don't need to just wait two years. Get going. Go get my career assessment. Okay.
Become an aspirant, and then we give you money so you can get the career assessment moving.
Okay.
Yeah. I think she's next year.
Okay. I'm just wondering if I can start to move in.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll have just two answers.
See, David, this is what I was saying.
Okay.
So that's the first thing I have to say. So I have to get my book out to find out what my number is.
The last one I was in just now. Congregational formation process. You know, it was one piece of everything we were doing, but it was extremely valuable to us, and it really got us.
It got us thinking about things in ways.
The part that I appreciated about it was really holding up the mirror. Is that you weren't
so you actually going to work it from up here?
For
yeah.
Admitting that,
and
yeah,
so and it wires over to there.
Really,
yes.
Well, as a gender queer person, there's a higher percentage.
Yeah, I hear you. 359, the power of accompaniment.
So, nice.
Excuse me. Is there a way for me to turn it off?
From the display. Let's get cued. But
without going through all that.
What? Is that going to do this display?
Well.
It might need to like get re-queued just because they projectors often fall asleep, sort of, in the same way computers do. So you might have to do the little turn on, turn off thing again if it's been too long.
But again, on a Windows machine, you go F4, you know, and toggle the projector off. You could toggle it back on. Mute it, so to speak. There you go.
This is display mirroring. It's a little different. Because that's saying, well, we can just do that for now.
Well, I can close this.
Close the computer?
No, that thing.
Oh, no, that's not coming up.
What it's doing is...
That's I love power stations. How did you do that? Is that this thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when my presentation is up, actually I want the mirroring off because Keynote will grab, because if the mirroring is on, then they'll see all the notes behind the presentation. And so if you turn the mirroring off, then it just sees the presentation as I have my notes go. Does that make sense?
Okay, so this is your thing here, right?
So if you press play and the mirroring is on, well, actually, if you do, well, I don't need the notes, actually, which is fine, but right now the mirroring is what, on or off?
So.
also get my, I know what my next slide is, I know, and then I can put my notes onto this page, whereas it's not showing up here. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And that's always helpful. But, so that's with mirroring off. But this is still on. Does that make sense?
Right. So when your show is off, what do we what's this going to be doing?
To say display mirroring off.
Yes.
What is that?
I don't know.
I know, it's terrible. There's so many good workshops that happen all at once. Yeah, I know.
I think
thank you. Hope your workshop goes well.
As it was.
Sure.
So David wants to sit up here because apparently he
because
needs to have
so
his computer
the way it is
there, but
off
I'm
right now,
put my
the map, like I was saying, that display comes up for me, but I have them all printed out as well, so it doesn't matter. But if you want the
how are you?
To turn it on.
You.
Then you'll see
oh, well,
that
I've missed you.
Exactly
I'll be back on Wednesday.
Yeah, but you're not.
Back in this, I mean, I'll be back at the church on Wednesday. Yeah.
So we can just do play.
Yeah, and then I'll
yep.
use my paper notes. That's fine.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And so
the flag yeah,
you're up there, then I'm
going
to go
take the
back
Arlington
here
flag
to
flip it because it has Guatemalan stuff, you know, fabric on the other side. But I completely forgot
what
about that
Arlington
idea.
Flag?
I
mean
banner
proof. Our banners. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this is good. This
but
is good.
To get iTunes.
Oh, well, I